some plants seem to thrive no matter what conditions or location or the amount of care we give them. Others seem to be disease magnets through and through. We're lucky to have a couple of experts here to help us figure out what went on in our gardens last year and how you can avoid those problems this time around. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. For this edition of Garden Talk, we're visiting with Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
And Laura Joel, Professor and Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. And good to see you again, Laura.
Yeah, you too, Larry. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And, you know, I'm just going to start with you, Laura. We've heard a lot about, and frankly, it's come up a lot on this show, a lot of winter damage to many woody ornamentals. And maybe talk a little bit about some of the signs of that damage.
Oh, yeah. I've had some in my yard. Many of the conifers or evergreens are showing browning, especially on the south or southwest side of a plant. This year, I'm actually seeing it even on the east side of a plant. We had a very long, cold winter. The temperatures weren't excessively cold, but it was for a very long time, and the ground was frozen. And what happens is a plant can't uptake water from the soil if it's frozen. And so the foliage that's evergreen dries out. This year I saw, even on the north side of my house, my hollies were incredibly winter burned, and I've never seen that on them over the course of the last 5 years. So, you know, a lot of people want to get out and prune. If it comes to something like a juniper, you can prune the dead branches out because they don't have latent buds farther back down on the stem. Whereas something like a boxwood or yew or arborvitae, many of those have latent buds or dormant buds farther back down on the stem that will eventually break this May as a new growth is flushed. And Mother Nature will tell you where to prune back to. I worry about the very tips of the branches of yews and other plants if they're if the buds are still alive or not. We just don't know yet, and we'll have to wait and see unless you want to cut open the buds and look inside.
Yeah, so it's kind of a wait and see. And that winter damage is going to affect flowering?
Only if the flower buds were killed. Okay. That's something I'm a little worried about with something like forsythias, where there's so many cultivars of forsythia out there, and some of them aren't reliably flower bud hardy. So if your forsythia flowers this year with only flowers on the lower part of the plant where the snow line was, that's a good indication that the flower buds were killed. But the vegetative buds are totally hardy for us.
Okay.
So still leaf out.
And not much we can do to help those plants recover. Just wait and see and maybe a saw.
Yeah, and everybody, you know, and a saw. That's good.
Applied to the stem.
Yeah. Renewal pruning. We always like to wait after the plant flowers before we do renewal pruning, but personally, I'd like to get in there when I can see the architecture of the plant and remove a third of the oldest branches back to the base of the plant on forsythias and lilacs, for example, and red-twig dogwoods.
Brian, how do you tell if there's damage to a plant that's caused by insects or some kind of fungus or other pathogen?
It can be very difficult. Oftentimes what we have to do is actually look at a sample of that sort in the lab because there are a lot of things that can be mimicked by both disease-causing organisms and insects. So Phil Pelletieri, who is now retired but was my colleague who dealt with the insect side of things, we would oftentimes trade samples back and forth and try to decide whether it was a disease or an insect problem. And PJ Leisch, who's his interim replacement, we've been doing that as well since he started March 1st. So it can be a little difficult. Oftentimes it takes a microscope. Oftentimes the things that you need to look for are not visible to the naked eye, so it can be a real challenge.
And there were some diseases that were a little prominent last year, perhaps more than other years.
I think tar spot was the big one that I saw, and that's in deference to Laura here, who's a woody ornamental lover, and that's on Norway maples in particular. We saw a lot of these very large, tarry-looking spots, and that's a fungal disease, actually, and it's been very prevalent the last probably 5 or 6 years. I've always seen a lot of that along the lake edge of Lake Michigan and the counties that kind of border Lake Michigan, but it's now started to move across the state into the western and more northwestern part of the state. And what we're seeing it on a lot is on Norway maple, and it's actually an introduced fungus. It's a European variant of the pathogen that comes in and tends to attack Norway maple. We have a native version of it as well that tends to go to silver maple.
Oh,
and yeah. I have to say, I was really excited. We did some workshops last fall, and a couple of the sites where we did the workshops, they had both silver and Norway maple. We were able to find tar spot on both of them. So as
you
a plant
like
pathologist,
diseases,
yeah,
don't
I really do. It's part of what I do, and I have to say, I do enjoy them. But other things we saw a lot of last year, there's this really cool disease on plums called plum pockets. And it's a fungal disease again, but it makes the fruits turn spongy and hollow.
Oh.
And we saw just a ton of that last year. And actually, I had a sample come in over the winter where there was still one of those kind of spongy fruits. It was frozen at this point because it was cold, but it was still on the tree, and somebody brought that in for an ID. We also saw a ton of what's called brown rot on plums and also on apples. And this is a fungal disease that on stone fruits like plum and cherry, it'll infect. You get this kind of buff-colored material that will grow on the surface of the fruit, and then eventually the fruits will mummify. And that was very prevalent last year as well.
Are there some, just to conclude on this, and then we'll take some calls, are there some that you're expecting, some diseases that you're expecting to see this year based on?
Tar spot we'll see a lot of, I'm sure. That one, the fungus overwinters in leaf debris. And if you're not diligent in cleaning up the leaves in your yard, which I'm sorry, folks, but I'm not. That fungus will survive and produce spores, and you'll get a lot of infections from that. So I think we'll see a lot of that. We see a lot of that every year. Other diseases that we're watching for, there's been a lot of talk about downy mildew on in patients. That's one that we have continued to have some problems on, although I don't think it'll be quite as serious a problem as it was in 2012. And also late blight is another one for vegetable gardeners. People get really, really concerned about those. And the other types of leaf blights on tomatoes are always very, very common. Powdery mildews are always very common. So those are pretty much guaranteed diseases that we're going to see.
And Laura, are there some woody ornamentals that are so prone to disease that you say, you know, you're really asking for trouble if you plant
them? Oh, yeah. Blue spruce. This is a big one. Colorado blue spruce, very disease prone. Austrian pine, Scots pine, all very disease prone. Obviously, ash, where it's not disease, but it could be disease, but it's emerald ash borer with ash trees. And speaking of emerald ash borer, it's prevalent in southern Wisconsin, eastern Wisconsin. And don't bring your firewood with you. If you go camping up north, leave your firewood at home. That is one way that emerald ash borer can be spread, is on firewood being transported to non-EAB areas. And we have quite a bit of black ash forests in the northern part of the state.
And I remember actually one of the first sightings of the ash borer was at a park in La Crosse, and they think it came from another state.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody brought the firewood in from another state.
Yeah.
Which is really too bad. Well, we're talking today with Brian Huddleston and Laura Jahl from the University of Wisconsin. Great to have them along for this edition of Garden Talk. You can join in with your questions and comments. I actually have an open line, a couple open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, taking a look at woody ornamentals. We're talking about disease. All kinds of things today with them. Lucy in Clintonville, it is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I planted a dwarf white pine last year, and it went into the fall looking absolutely gorgeous, beautiful, intense green, and it was well watered. But everything that was above the snow line, and quite a bit of it was covered by snow, but that part that was exposed got freeze-dried, and I was hoping that would be the extent of it, because when the snow melted, the rest was green. But it seems as though the tree is starting to look kind of dry. And I'm wondering if I have to cut off those dry parts, that there's some sort of expiration through those dry needles that would cause me to have to get rid of them.
Okay, Lucy, with your dwarf white pine, I have a couple in my yard too. The stuff that's beneath the snow line was protected from the damaging dry winds, especially newly planted ornamentals, whether it's deciduous or evergreen. This winter, there's quite a bit of desiccation on the leaves, if they're evergreen, or twigs, if they're deciduous. Stuff that is well watered going into the fall, going into the winter, has a better chance of less damage. However, again, we're seeing so much damage across the state. With pines, the needles that are brown will eventually fall off this spring. The thing I want you to avoid is pruning just yet. Wait for the buds to break. And with pines, the buds are only at the terminal tips of the branches. And when they start to elongate, they're called candles. And that's like an immature twig with very short needles, and then the needles elongate. So I would wait until that occurs, late May up to, or maybe even until June, before you decide to prune those out. Because a lot of times it'll shed its bad needles, and then the new growth will come and it'll hide some of the damage. If the candles do not emerge this spring, then that material is probably dead. You can always scratch the twig and see if it's green underneath. But again, with pines, only the tips of the branches is where the new growth occurs. Mm-hmm. They don't have latent buds farther back down.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Lucy. I want to give Rich in Sauk County a chance to join in. Hi, Rich. Thank you for calling.
Yes. The last 2 years on my green beans, I've had, and I Googled this, what they call a mosaic wilt or a mosaic blight or something. What do you know about that, and how do you prevent that?
What sort of symptoms are you seeing on the bean plants?
Oh, shrinked up leaves, and veined, you know. I mean, they just look sick. You know, they, you know, like the leaves are, you know, a normal, healthy plant, they look like a bean leaf. But this is, they like to shrink up half the size and look kind of wrinkled, and there's a little bit of discolor.
Okay, is the tissue in between the veins, is that still intact, or is that dried up and died?
Pardon?
Have the tissue between the veins and the leaves, has that dried up, or is it still pretty intact?
Yeah, it's pretty intact. It isn't okay. Like something's eating it, no.
Okay. No. There are some viral diseases, and mosaic, there is a mosaic blight that occurs on beans that it could possibly be. There are a wide variety of different types of viruses that it could be. Was this pretty uniform across all of your beans, or was it individual plants? The other thing I would worry about if you're seeing a lot of growth distortions, did you see any sort of symptoms on any other of your other vegetables, or was it just the beans?
No, just basically on the beans.
Okay, and where are the beans located in relationship to the rest of your garden? Are they along the edge? Are they in the interior?
Yeah, they're kind of along the edge.
Okay, do you use any herbicides on your lawn by any chance?
Pardon?
Do you use any herbicides on your lawn by any chance?
Well, no, I don't.
Okay. Because the other thing I was thinking of that can cause distortions in plants can be herbicides, particularly those that are in lawn care products. So you do have to be careful about that.
No, it's a little bit odd
for me that, all of your plants are showing it, and it's only your snap beans. There is certainly some possibility that maybe it was brought in as a seed-borne pathogen. Some of the viruses are brought in on seed, but usually it's not everything. It's usually a few of the plants will show symptoms, at least initially. What I would suggest that you do you have a digital camera by any chance?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I would suggest when you plant your beans this year, watch for the symptoms. And if you end up seeing those symptoms again, take some photos and email them to me. And let me give my email out. And it is PDDC. P as in Paul, D as in David, D as in David again, C as in Charles, at plantpath, PLANTPATH, dot WISC, short for Wisconsin, dot EDU. So I'd actually like to see the symptoms on this. Because viral diseases are a little bit unusual on beans in Wisconsin. I think of that as being a slightly more tropical sort of thing. That doesn't rule that out. It may be that you've got something that I just haven't seen before.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, when I looked on the Google, you know, and they said, well, this is transmitted by aphids, and I'm thinking,
no, and you're kind of breaking up right now, so we're going to have to let you go.
Aphids certainly can move viruses around, and the other thing, the reason if it were specifically the sorts of viruses I'm thinking of, some of them are white fly transmitted, and again, we typically don't see a lot of that outdoors here in Wisconsin in the summer, but there certainly are a lot of plant viruses that are moved around by aphids. But again, the viruses that I'm most familiar with that are aphid transmitted tend to go to other types of plants as well. So if you're growing tomatoes or peppers or any of the cucurbits, so squash, pumpkin, cucumbers, I would expect possible transmission to those hosts as well. And so because it's specifically on the beans, that's what's kind of stymieing me here.
And thanks a lot for calling, Rich. And please do follow up with that photo. That's actually something that you'd be interested in seeing.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious because we don't get a lot of snap bean samples that come in and to the clinic. So I'm always interested when it's a kind of an unusual host for us to see diseases on.
Taking a look at woody ornamentals today, talking about diseases as well with our two guests, Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison and Laura Jull, professor and extension specialist in woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my two guests, Brian Huddleston and Laura Jull of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. Have an open line for you. Did you have a problem with a disease last year in your garden that you couldn't get rid of? Do you have a favorite tree or shrub that you want to talk about? Or maybe you're interested in getting some and would like some advice. Laura can certainly give you that advice. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We do have a Facebook question from Bob who says we have many smaller 3-inch diameter white pines, which normally are thick with needles. Now the trees are still green, sparsely needled, and don't have their usual full look. Is this the same thing that you've been talking about, Laura, pretty much?
Well, with white pine, they retain their needles for about 2 years.
Okay.
And the inner needles naturally shed. If you're seeing the outer needles towards the ends of the branches shedding, that's bad. That's real bad. So white pine, they over time, they're not as fluffy looking as when they're young. Now, I assume this plant is fully established with a 3-inch diameter, but I don't know. But if it is fully established, I would, water your tree as in spring, obviously. You might want to fertilize it. Again, slow-release fertilizers are better than quick-release fertilizers. And don't add a lot of nitrogen. I do not use turf fertilizers on your trees. They're often too high in nitrogen and aren't the best. Again, it could be due to the winter damage, if it's especially on the needles that are above the snow line.
Turning to Matt in Springbrook next. Hi, Matt. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how you guys doing? I've got a bit of a problem this year when I get to planting. I'm going to have to run my crop of potatoes alongside where my tomatoes are going to go, and I was wondering if that was going to be a problem.
Disease issues.
Yeah,
I was thinking, Brian.
Certainly you can have diseases that will occur on both of those types of vegetables. The one that comes to mind most typically, or two actually, early blight and late blight. Early blight is one of the more common foliar diseases that oftentimes will cause a loss of leaves from the bottom of the plant upward. And typically with tomatoes, it will leave fruit intact. So you do get some fruit off of the plants. But it can cause a fair amount of yield loss if it occurs early and the defoliation occurs really early in the spring. So that would be a disease that could transfer over. Late blight is a much more serious disease. If that's introduced, that particular pathogen can typically infect both hosts. Oftentimes, there are a lot of kind of variants of that particular organism, and some of the variants tend to prefer potatoes versus tomatoes. Others prefer tomatoes a little bit more than potatoes. But usually by the end of the growing season, you'll see that disease if you have it in your area on both of those crops. The other thing I would worry a little bit about if you've been growing potatoes and tomatoes and also things like peppers and eggplants for a long period of time, you can get buildup of a fungus called verticillium in the soil. This is a vascular wilt organism. It gets into the root system and then colonizes the water conducting tissue in the plants and blocks it off. So it causes a wilt. It prevents water from getting from the roots to the upper part of the plant. That can occur in both of those hosts. And then there are some viruses that certainly can go to both of those hosts as well. So you have to keep in mind, potatoes and tomatoes are very closely related botanically. They're in the same plant family. So they tend to be prone to a lot of the same disease problems.
And have you gotten the snow shoveled away in order to get the garden planted?
Oh.
I know. Springbrook is pretty far north, so that would be, there's a lot of snow on the ground, I'm pretty sure, yet in Springbrook. Thanks, Matt, for calling. That'd be up, maybe 20 miles from Hayward or so. Cheryl in Sheboygan, it's your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, we have several holly plants in front of our house, and the top two-thirds has all gone brown over the winter.
Yeah.
Dried out.
I also have the same problem, and I've had these holly bushes for about 5 years, and I've never had any winter burn, and they're facing north. They're totally protected. So I sympathize with you for having the leaves turning brown. This is an evergreen holly, I assume, and those leaves aren't going to come back. They're going to fall off, but I would wait to prune because hollies have lots of buds along the stem, and those buds may break and form new leaves this spring. It really depends on how bad the damage was. You can always scratch the stems and look underneath, and if it's still green underneath, then I would leave it alone. But if it's totally brown, breaks off easily, then those twigs are dead. But I'm trying to wait, even though it looks really bad on my shrubs, but I'm trying to wait to prune those to see if those buds break this spring.
There you go.
If they start to rebud, then just let them go.
But yeah, those leaves are going to fall off, or you could pull the leaves off if it's just so annoying.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Cheryl. Tracy in Wauwatosa. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. 8 years ago, I planted an autumn brilliance serviceberry tree on my own, and it seems to be, after 8 years, more like a Charlie Brown tree. I was told it was going to get big, and it's maybe 6.5 feet tall and like 5 feet wide. It does flower. I just assumed it would be bigger, and I planted it when my son was born, and I was hoping it would be nice and maybe a little bigger, and I get different answers from people that they only get that big, and as long as it's flowering, it's healthy. I mean, I don't want to get rid of it, but it's in my front yard, and I was hoping it would be a little bigger.
Yeah. I have that exact cultivar in my yard, and they do get bigger than 6 feet. I can guarantee you that. One thing about serviceberries is they are generally slower growing compared to some other species. It's a phenomenal plant. I absolutely love the fruit. The fruit is delicious. Great on pancakes, by the way.
And it's a great tree from a disease standpoint as well. And I mean that in a good way. It tends not to get a lot of disease problems.
Yeah. Great jam, too.
Yeah. Oh, it's delicious. And the birds love it, too.
Like it.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
the birds will beat you to it half the time.
Oh, yeah. I have a robin that robs me of my service berries. When it comes to very small, and it's been in the ground for 8 years, is it in a fully exposed area or is it shaded?
No, lots of sun.
Okay.
It gets lots of sun.
Okay.
I thought shade right away, too, because I had that issue with mine.
Yeah, because if it's in too much shade, they're not going to grow very big or very fast. The other thing is... I'm sorry?
Someone said maybe I didn't spread the roots out when I first planted it, and I don't really remember. It was 8 years ago, and I had my newborn right there, and I was just like wanted to get the tree in the ground, and I'm wondering, is it the way I planted it?
Well,
girdling.
That was the next question I had. Was this grown in a container, or was it grown bald and burlapped?
It was in burlap.
Okay. When you planted it, did you remove the wire basket or as much of it as you could?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I removed all the stuff
around it. And the burlap and the twine. Okay, that's good. What kind of soil do you have?
Clay.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
Yeah, that's not a good thing for serviceberry. They don't like heavy clay soils. They like more organic, loamy type soils, a little bit looser. You know, adding compost, but again, keep any type of compost or mulch away from touching the trunks of those branches. That can rot those branches at the base. I'm seeing a lot of mulch volcanoes so far this spring, which drives me crazy. It's a sure way to kill a tree. Keep the mulch away from the base of the plant. You probably, you know, since it's already planted in the soil, I would probably just try to, you can't really amend the soil because it's already in the ground, but adding compost to the top of the soil, no more than 2 inches, and again, keeping it away from touching those stems. And over time, that compost will slowly break down and potentially help the tree a little bit. But yeah, clay soils is really bad for serviceberry.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Lita in Monona. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Okay, thanks for taking my call. We have some cherry trees and a peach tree that we were going to trim today. And I'm wondering if it's a good time of year to trim fruit trees.
Well, the thing about fruit trees is if you're pruning them now, you're removing some of the flower buds, and that will impact your fruit for this year.
Will it impact the fruit on the other branches, you mean, that we don't cut off?
No, it won't. It's only the branches that you take out because you're removing some of the flowering wood, which would produce fruit this year.
Okay.
One thing about stone fruit, the trees need a lot of aeration. So opening it up so that there's good airflow in the plant is important to help reduce disease. I know Brian's nodding his head. Stone fruits have a lot of disease issues and insect issues. Brian's smiling.
Yeah.
If you do remove some of the branches now, that's fine. Make sure to do the three-point method of branch removal if it's a larger branch over an inch or so in diameter. And I do have a fact sheet.
It's available on our, if you go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu, click on the fact sheet tab in the main page, and that'll take you to an alphabetical listing. And they should be under how to properly prune trees. Deciduous
and,
trees.
Yeah, it's more deciduous tree-based, but the concepts are the same, and the three-point method of branch removal is demonstrated in that.
Yeah, the other thing you might, since you're growing stone fruits, there's a really nice publication through our UW Extension Publications unit called How Growing Stone Fruits in Wisconsin, Growing Cherries, Plums, and Peaches in Wisconsin. And if you go to that website, which is learningstore.uwex.edu, and just type in plums, and you'll see this one of the publications that'll pop up will be this multi-page, lovely publication. They have a lovely series on growing all kinds of fruits, but it talks about pruning and establishing and everything you want to know about growing stone fruits.
And so, if you didn't get that, all those sites, you can just go to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We've got links. So
thank you so much.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Margaret and Seymour, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've been having this the last year of growing. We had a lot of problem, and it started with our pickle vines. And I don't know if it's a disease or a beetle or what it was, mm-hmm. but from the pickle vines, it went to the squash, to the pumpkins. And we even had another garden way away from that was with watermelon and muskmelon, and they were attacking that. So I don't know, is that a beetle or a disease or what?
Could be an insect or a disease problem. I'm more inclined, given the multiple locations, you're having a problem at several different sites, that it might be an insect problem more likely than a disease. But there's a vine borer that will go to plants in that particular group. What I would do if you happen to see vines wilting again this year would be to cut off some of those vines and kind of slip them along the length of the vine. And if you've got this vine borer, you'll see little larvae, grubs that are inside the vines. So that's certainly one possibility.
What does that larvae look like?
It'll be small. I think it's whitish. And you'll be able to see them. They're usually pretty visible. And that can cause a fair amount of damage. They bore in.
Yeah,
and then
they wipe out everything.
Yeah. The other thing from a disease standpoint, if you've grown these crops kind of in the same area over a long period of time, there is this fungus called verticillium that can infect the plants and then block water movement from the roots into the vines. That will cause wilting as well. Did you see a lot of cucumber beetles by any chance?
I did see a few beetles, but I didn't think that the cucumber beetle would go to all the other kind of vines.
They will go to the cucurbits in general, so that includes the squash, pumpkin, anything in that group. And that particular insect will do some feeding damage on its own, but it can also carry a bacterial pathogen. Uh-huh. And that one will get inside once it's fed. The bacterium gets in through those feeding wounds, and that will block off water movement as well. And that can cause some vine dieback as well. It usually will kill the plants totally.
Yes,
so there are several things that you could be dealing with. Again, if you really want to know exactly what it is, I would suggest if you see this again, get a sample into your county extension office for them to take a look at. And if they think it's necessary, they can forward it on to either the insect diagnostician or myself here in Madison.
All right.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Margaret, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Audra in Madison, your turn next. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I am looking for plant recommendations. We live in a new development that's on the top of a hill, and it's very windy. I want to have birds in my yard, so I'd like to have somewhere for them to hang out and some shelter for them and a little privacy from my neighbors. But I'm afraid to plant anything because it looks like everything that's evergreen is always windburnt.
That's a good question, Audra. Especially this year, there's a lot of things. I've had plants in my yard that are been in the ground for years, and I had some winter burn on it this year. I would stay away from white pine in particular, red pine, if it's such a windy site, because those are a little bit more susceptible to windburn. I probably would go with like a Serbian spruce or a white spruce. Black Hills spruce is another one. And Brian would agree with me on this one. I do not recommend a Colorado blue spruce.
I knew what she was going to say, and no, definitely not. No Colorado blue spruce.
I would avoid, personally, Austrian and Scots pine because of all the disease and insect issues that they have. You could try, I'm trying to think. Most of the five-needle pines are a little bit more susceptible to windburn. I've had better luck with Japanese white pine, though there's so many different cultivars and they all look kind of different, but that tree naturally grows on the shores of Japan and it's actually tolerant to salt spray as well as wind. So
it's hardy.
Pardon?
So it's a very hardy plant.
It's cold hardy, yeah. It's a zone 5, okay. And you're in Madison, so you could do it.
Mm-hmm. Any of the firs, Laura?
Firs, Concolor is a little bit better, but, you know, in a very exposed site, they could have some damage.
You know, it's not so much that we're so, I mean, we have very close neighbors. It's just that we're on the top of this hill, and that's where the wind comes from. Is there anything that's going to be narrow enough to fit between, like, my fence and my alleyway?
Okay, that was my next
question. Something that's probably 10 feet or less in diameter.
Oh, much smaller than what I just recommended.
Which I would love to have pines. I would love to have them, but I just don't think we have enough space for them. And, you know, the spruces are my favorite trees, but that's sort of out of the question, too.
Well, there are some cultivars of spruce, of Norway spruce in particular. One is called, it's a Norway spruce, and the cultivar name is Cupressina, and it's Cupressina, something like that. And that is a more narrow one. It's a little bit harder to find. There are some nurseries, large nurseries in the state that do carry it. I would, if it's very windy site, there are arborvitae, but I worry about the windburn damage. But how far or how much space do you have to plant? Can the plant get 15 feet tall and 10 feet wide? Or... Okay.
Yes, absolutely. It's the space that I'm looking to fill is I can go as high as I want to, but it's about 40 by 13.
13 feet wide. Okay. Then I would recommend there is a fairly new juniper out. It's a tree form, and it's called Star Power. And Star Power Juniper doesn't get real wide. It has a nice color to it. The foliage is prickly, but the birds do like it. They do nest in those plants. And that would tolerate the wind, and it doesn't get real big in terms of spread. So and there are other cultivars, tree cultivars of juniper, especially the Chinese juniper, that you could use.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Oh my gosh!
On the on this new variety, do you see many disease problems?
No, Star Power. We're not seeing Phomopsis.
Okay.
It's a very nice one.
That's a common fungal disease that I see on junipers. So you have to be careful of that.
Yeah, it's a new selection from Johnson's Nursery.
All right.
Oh, thank you so much. I've been looking and looking and
no problem.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Happy spring.
Yeah, you too. As well. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I almost forgot that number. Can you believe it? 1-800-642-1234, just momentarily. Kate at Amherst Junction, thanks a lot for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. We have an oak tree. I believe it's either a black or a white-black hybrid. It's a mature tree. It's about 30 feet tall. And over the last several years, it's developed some large galls or burls on many of the branches.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine there are probably 20 on this one tree. But another oak also developed a few galls. And we have some wild cherry in the understory that have those black galls that the cherries seem to get. Do you have any idea what these are and what we should do about them?
They would be different diseases on those two hosts. The easy answer is for what you're seeing on the cherry. That's a disease called black knot. I affectionately call that one poop on a stick because that's what it looks like. And it's a fungal disease, and you can actually tell whether you have cherries or plums around in the wintertime by looking for that particular swollen mass on the branches. On oak trees, and these are actually on the branches?
Yes.
Okay.
Smaller branches towards the top, not the major trunk branches.
My first thought, there is a Phomopsis gall that occurs. It's a fungal gall, and I do see that occasionally on oaks. I can see that on other types of deciduous trees as well. That's a possibility of what you could be dealing with. Typically, these are non-lethal. They won't kill the branches. They just look kind of disturbing, particularly when you see them in the wintertime and there are no leaves. But usually during the summertime, there's enough foliage that you won't even know that they're there. You could potentially prune them out if you wanted to, but usually I tell folks not to bother with that particular disease. And if you do decide to prune them out, you have to be very, very, very careful when you do that. I would actually wait until next winter and do that when the trees are dormant. We're a much more serious problem in oaks than those galls would be oak wilt. And if you prune at the wrong time, you open the trees up to a higher probability of getting oak wilt.
Another thing, it could be due to a wasp insect that creates those galls on the branches. And you can always cut those galls open and see if there's any insect feeding on the inside. A lot of times you'll see a little exit hole from the insect.
I usually see those more on like petioles or smaller branches. If it's bigger, woodier branches, I'm more inclined to think it's probably a fungal infection. But yeah, we do see a lot of galls from wasps on oaks, but they tend to be on the leaves and on the smaller branches.
There you go.
Is it likely to be a problem for other trees in our woods? We live in a mixed mixed species woods, and we have apple trees. Is this going to be a problem for them?
Probably not on the apples. Some of the other trees in the forested area might become infected if it's this Phomopsis organism. But again, it tends to be a very, very cosmetic sort of disease. It's not going to kill the trees. So I would not be concerned from that perspective.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at plant diseases today and taking a look at woody ornamentals with our two guests, Brian Huddleston, who directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Laura Joll, professor of horticulture and extension specialist for woody ornamentals at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my two guests from the University of Wisconsin, College of Ag and Life Sciences, Brian Huddleston and Laura Joll. So happy to have them along. And again, thank you for listening. Question for them, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And another Laura from the Department of Natural Resources posted something for us. She wanted to provide an invitation to those who will be in the Madison area next Friday. And if you're looking for an Arbor Day program, you can join the Wisconsin Nursery Association and the Wisconsin Arborist Association and DNR Forestry on the Capitol grounds at the corner of Carroll and Mifflin. That's on Friday, April 25th at 12:15 for the planting of a big red oak, a big one. And Ken Longquist is going to be there. Musician is going to entertain and lead us in song. He does a great job. And we'll also read the governor's Arbor Day proclamation and plant that huge. Now, we're not talking about a six-incher here. We're talking about many feet, a big one, to replace one that was lost. So a special book is going to be available for children who attend and a limited number of white spruce tree seedlings for distribution. And I've been to this event in previous years as a member of the Dane County Tree Board. And we never planted a great big red oak, but we planted some other trees and just had a really nice time. It's really a lot of fun. So that's next Friday at 12:15. Barb in Nakusa has a question for you guys. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I have well-established rose bushes, and for the last 2-3 years, I get these big, beautiful buds, but then they never open. They just stay very tight, and they just don't open.
Yeah, they turn brown eventually?
Yes.
Yeah, it's probably a disease called gray mold or botrytis blight. That's a very common fungal disease. The fungus itself is kind of a wimpy pathogen. It doesn't oftentimes infect leaves, but it does like the kind of more tender flower tissue, and it will get into those buds. And not only on roses, but we see this on things like peonies, even tulips, dahlias, and it will cause the flowers to not open and abort eventually. So one of the things you want to try to do is, how are the plant, these shrubs located? Are they in kind of a enclosed area? Have you pruned them lately?
No, I haven't. I've just been letting them going, thinking they would fix themselves.
Yeah, my suggestion would be to do at least a little bit of thinning on those shrubs. And what you want to do is kind of open up airflow so things dry out a little bit better. And sometimes that can help eliminate that particular disease. It probably won't totally eliminate it, but it certainly can help. With most fungal diseases, they tend to like wetter conditions. So anything you can do to promote more rapid drying of the plants, if they get wet, to kind of move out humid air from around the plant, that can be very, very important. And that's oftentimes a function of how closely you have plant space together and how much foliage is growing in one place. So thinning is very important, and not packing a lot of plants into a small area is very important. If you get absolutely desperate, there are some fungicide treatments that you could consider applying as preventative treatments. You'd have to catch the plants as they're beginning to bud and apply these products over time. But I would try modifying the environment a little bit before you go to the chemical route.
Okay, I had hollyhocks right next to them, and they've all just died away. They're gone.
Yeah, that might be something different. I don't normally think of gray mold as a big problem on hollyhocks per se, but there are other things certainly that would cause some problems on hollyhocks.
Hollyhocks are really susceptible to Japanese beetles.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
I have grapes, so definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, you got grapes, too?
Oh, boy. That's salad bar for Japanese beetles.
the roses, the Japanese beetle, if the botrytis doesn't get them first, the Japanese beetle will take them out.
Yeah.
They like roses as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
You bet. Appreciate your call.
And we do have a fact sheet on that particular disease, again, at my website, if anyone is interested in reading a little bit more about that.
Oma in Montello. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering the best time to trim maple trees.
Okay. When it comes to maples and most deciduous plants, especially oaks and elms as well, the dormant season is the best time to prune before the leaves emerge. Typically, you know, late winter, early spring is a very good time to prune these trees. One thing I want to mention, if it is anything that requires any type of climbing or large branch removal, I highly suggest you contact an International Society of Arboriculture, or ISA, certified arborist for hire. And you can find a list of those based on where you live in the state by county on the Wisconsin Arborist Association website. And all you do is just Google Wisconsin Arborist Association. Their webpage will come up. And then on the left-hand side, it'll say Certified Arborist for Hire. You click on that, then you click on your county, and a list will come up of what arborists that are certified can prune your trees. I want to make that very clear to everybody in the state. Don't do any pruning where you need to climb your tree for large branch removal. It's just too dangerous, and we should really leave that up to the experts. Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize ISA certified, because those people have gone through training, have taken a test, and they know what they're doing. Unfortunately, there are some companies out there that call themselves tree pruners and are not trained. So I really recommend for the large trees. How big is your tree?
Oh, they're probably, the largest trunk is maybe 6 inches in diameter. They're not that big a tree.
Okay.
And all I want to do is trim off the bottom branches.
Okay.
So I'll be able to mow the lawn.
Sure, sure. I totally understand. You could do it now. Again, for any type of limb, you know, larger than like an inch in diameter, you want to do the 3-point method of branch removal, doing an undercut and then a cut on the outside of that and then another cut. You don't want to cut into the branch collar. And I know that sounds confusing. Again, you can look at my fact sheet on the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic's website. And I have, there's a whole bunch of different fact sheets, and there is one on how to properly prune deciduous trees. And there's a diagram on there to show you how to properly do the 3-point method of branch removal.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. And Brad in La Crosse, hi. Brad, are you there?
Yes, I am. I was looking for some kind of windbreak, preferably a pine and heavy clay soils on a hillside.
Oh, boy. heavy clay soils, most conifers do not like, especially white pine. They do not like that, and they don't like windy locations. And again, I don't recommend Austrian or Scots pines, even though they can tolerate heavier soils. They just have so many insect and disease problems. Are you really set on a pine, or could you go with like a spruce?
Oh, that would work too.
Okay.
My neighbor has some, I think they're spruce.
Okay. No Colorado blue spruce. I don't recommend those, but perhaps a white spruce or black spruce. Black Hill spruce, that is, not black spruce. Two different plants. But white spruce or Black Hill spruce, you can also go with some of the larger tree forms of juniper. Those can tolerate heavier soils as long as they're well-drained. If there's any standing water, neither one of those will work.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Scott in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question about using Roundup, and please hold your judgment about using Roundup.
I use
don't
it.
Like it either. But I want to use Roundup on a terrace area in Madison near a maple tree, and I wonder how close I can get without affecting the roots of the tree.
Okay, that's a very good question, Scott. When Roundup is a systemic herbicide, and anything it touches, it could potentially kill it. It's transferred from the foliage down to the roots. And I use Roundup for some of the toughest weeds that I just can't get rid of, especially thistles. I don't really want to pull those spiny things, so I spray Roundup on them, and it works. Now, I don't know if you're going to be spraying on top of the root system. If it has any exposed roots, you definitely want to keep it Roundup away from the bark of the tree. Do not spray anything that is going to touch the trunk of the tree or its surface roots.
So if you apply it with a paintbrush or something instead of
There's Wix.
Spray.
Yeah, there's other application methods you can use with Roundup where you target specific weeds that you're not spraying it over the entire area.
Okay, yes, I've used the paintbrush method in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Should be
and
okay.
And I have one other question that I didn't ask when I was at the caller, or the initial caller.
Yeah?
It's about a staghorn, cut-leaf staghorn
sumac. Yep. Mine are you talking about tiger eyes?
I don't believe so. It's,
okay.
The Latin name is R-H-U-S.
Yeah, Rus typhina.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And my landscape architect recommended them, but they're very invasive, and I initially planted three of them, and now I have 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rus typhina, staghorn sumac, the species itself is aggressive. It's native, and it spreads by suckers predominantly. Now, the cutleaf form can also be quite aggressive. The tiger eyes I mentioned previously is a cutleaf Rus typhina, or staghorn sumac, but with gold foliage throughout the summer. I have some in my yard, and they're absolutely beautiful. They almost look Asian. They're very cool. They're less aggressive than the species because, obviously, with the yellow leaves, they don't have as much chlorophyll, so they're not growing as fast as all green form. However, they do spread by root suckers. So if you're going to plant one of those, plant it in a smaller location that it can spread.
There we go. And good luck. And thank you very, very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Boy, all kinds of things to talk about, haven't we? Our guests today, Brian Huddleston, is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the University of Wisconsin. He's in the Department of Plant Pathology. Laura Jowell, a professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals. She works out of the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm Larry Mueller. And you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, keeping your garden healthy and thriving takes a lot of work, but there are ways that you can identify and treat many of the diseases before they can do a lot of damage. And then if you carefully select the types of plants and woody ornamentals for your garden, you're gonna really come out to the, I think, to the good. And to help you get to the good, Laura Jowell, one of our guests, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture. Thank you for joining us, Laura.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me again.
You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Terry in Green Bay, who's been waiting a while. Terry, thank you for waiting.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm roughly 15, 20 miles north of Green Bay. My question is, with the lingering cold weather, do you think it's still a little late to be pruning on either? I have a couple American elms, smaller branches. This will be now. So American elms or red oak?
I would say it's not too late, especially way up there. It's still, you know, a lot of snow up there. And the insect that transfers oak wilt, the picnic beetle, isn't quite active yet way up there. Generally, down in this part of the state, about April 15th, April 1st, is when we recommend not to prune oaks anymore. With American elm, it's probably, again, are you in Oconto, by the way?
I'm just a little bit south of there.
Yeah, I have family up in Oconto. They still have snow up there, unfortunately, yeah, for them. But yeah, I don't think it's too late to prune American elm that far north.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the main thing, if you're really concerned about pruning, you could go ahead and do it, but just have some pruning paint or some leftover latex paint right with you when you make the cuts, and then paint over the wounds, because that's just an added insurance just in case some of the insects are around that might transmit disease-causing organisms.
Yeah, same with the oak, and that is the only time we recommend using tree paint or wound compound is if you absolutely have to prune an oak or an elm during the growing season. You immediately after cutting it, put that compound on it, and otherwise we do not recommend using that material at all. In fact, it can slow down wound closure. But for especially for the oak wilt, the picnic beetle is attracted to fresh wounds. Yeah. And so we want to protect those trees. But that's the only time we recommend that.
And there's some work that indicates, research that indicates that the sap beetles that can move the oak wilt fungus around can visit a fresh cut within 10 minutes. So that's why you have to do it immediately.
Yeah, you can't wait. Good luck, Terry. Thank you for calling. Doug in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've got a large maple in my yard, and the roots are not showing, but there are, like, knobs or knots that are sticking out through the lawn. Can I shave those off?
Are they sure they're coming from the roots?
They sure look like it.
Okay, I would not shave those off. That just means that the roots are shallow, and they're probably seeking out oxygen. They're coming close to the surface, and anytime you saw something like that off, you're opening up the roots.
Right.
You're wounding it, and disease pathogens can move in.
Yeah, I'd be very concerned. There's a fungal pathogen called armillaria, and it tends to be more of a problem farther north in the state, and that one tends to enter into root systems through wounds. So I'd be very, very cautious about doing anything of that sort.
Okay, so then can I cover them up?
Well, with mulch, you mean?
Well, with soil.
You know, again, it sounds like the soil there might be a little compacted and the roots are coming closer to the surface. So if you are going to cover them up, I would use something like a bark mulch. And again, no more than a couple inches, and keep it away from the trunk of the tree.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jason in Waukesha. Hello.
Hi there. I actually just moved into a new home that spring, and we have a huge section in our front yard that's just bare right up against our house. And I want to grow something in there. However, the previous owner said he never did anything because there's way too much shade.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the house, we have those one large leaf shade-loving plants.
Hostas, yes. Those are perennials. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm trying to find something different than that to put, I guess, in the front to provide some color and just some look and, you know, better landscaping.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Any suggestions?
Yeah. For evergreens, you can use yews, but they're all green. They're not going to be, you know, flowers on them per se. Yews work well. Boxwood works well. Also in the shade, I don't know, probably since you're in Waukesha, your pH is probably high. You could also go, I'm trying to think, most of the ones that I have in my shade side of my house are for acid soils, and I've been amending the soil, so those aren't going to work for you. There's also a plant called Cool Splash Dervilla, and Cool Splash Dervilla. It's D-I-E-R-V-I-L-L-A. The leaves are variegated, so they're white and green, and they provide a lot of color, even though they're not in flower. The flowers do occur at the tips of the branches. They're not overly showy, but they can work, especially for brightening up a spot in the front of your house. I don't know. How exposed is it?
You mean to light?
No, to wind and...
Oh.
Is it facing north, east?
It's facing north, and I want to put it right up against our garage because I actually live on a corner lot, so in order for people to come through our front yard, they have to go through the sidewalk all the way around. Otherwise, they have to go through the garage, and I want to build a walkway on the side of our garage so people that want to come in, they can go through the walkway, and I want to just try to find plants to build up against that walkway there. So I don't want any evergreens that are too big that's going to spread
out
and grow into the house.
Yeah. Boy, most of the plants I'm thinking of are just going to get too big.
Yeah, you may want to go with herbaceous plants that like shade. And for that, I'm certainly not an expert on that. But we do have, we have a weekly teleconference program. And last year, one of the sessions was on shade-loving herbaceous plants. And if you want to email me, I can send you information from that particular session. We have both a podcast and also a written summary that I could send you that'll have information on varieties and different types of plants that you could plant in that area.
And for perennials, there's quite a few besides hostas you can use. There's some ornamental grasses, Japanese, I can never say that one. It's variegated grass. It's specifically for shade. I have it. And some of the other plants, you can go with pulmonarias or lungwort. That does very well. Coral bells can tolerate partial shade. I mean, there is a plethora of plants, herbaceous plants you can use for shade, and they're quite lovely.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And your email again
is PDDC. So plant, short for Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, PDDC at PlantPath, PlantPath dot WISC dot EDU. Also, if you go to my website, there's a contact page on there, and you can email me that way as well.
And we have that link on my Facebook page, too. So there you go. Thanks, Jason, for calling. Darren in Milwaukee, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks a lot for the show.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question on some type of a growth that I've been seeing on some trees, whether it is a fungus or a bug nest of some sort. What I've seen is, I know I've seen it on some aspen or birch on the east shore of Lake Peatonwell in central Wisconsin,
yep.
And it tends to come out at the tips of branches, mostly at the tips, at the top of branches, at the top of the tree, sometimes in some outliers, but it's always on the tips, and it sort of looks like a, from a distance, it almost looks like, you know, dried up oak leaves that haven't fallen off the tree. But when you get closer and look,
bronze birch borer,
it's almost
maybe?
like a shelf fungus of some sort, kind of a knobby, fungusy
sure?
type of a thing.
You sure, Darren, it's not the fruit?
Yeah.
How big is it?
It sure doesn't. I mean, I took a sample. It sure doesn't look like. I mean, you mean like the pet, like the growth that kind of looks like a pine cone type of a
yeah.
growth? You mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely not that.
Okay.
And they're kind of. Yeah, I mean, I'd say the size, maybe 3 inches, 4 inches in diameter, and it's sort of a inconsistent shape. And it's very hard, almost, again, like a hardened shelf fungus of some sort, but it's not like a horizontal, solid horizontal pattern.
Yeah, but you said this is at the tips of the branches.
Correct.
Yeah, and I wouldn't expect shelf fungi or any of those sorts of fungi
right.
to be on the branch tips. Do you have a digital camera?
I have a sample, but not with me.
Okay. What you could do is actually get that into your county extension office in Milwaukee and have them take a look at it and see if they can identify it there. Otherwise, if they can't, they could send it in. My first thought is it may be something insect-related, some sort of gall of some kind, in which case they can forward it on to PJ Leisch, who's our current insect diagnostician, and he could take a look at it and ID it for you.
Mm-hmm. All right. There you go.
Madison. And where would I send that again?
You could either, if you're from Milwaukee County, is that correct?
I'm in Milwaukee right now, but I have the sample in Madison.
Oh, in Madison. You could drop that. You could actually drop that down to campus if you're familiar with the campus area where the Babcock Dairy store is. We're in the building right across the street, 1630 Linden Drive. And then you'll go up to second floor, room 240 is where PJ is located. I would take it to him first.
Uh-huh. There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much. And, you know, any weekday, 8 to 4:30?
Yeah, approximately. And if you can't find PJ, I'm down in room 183 of the same building, and you can drop it off at my clinic. We trade samples all the time. So
there you go. Good luck, Darren. Thank you so much for calling. I want to give Larry and Rice Lake a chance to join in. Hi, Larry.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm calling with your opinions on the suitability of growing dawn redwoods in northwest Wisconsin. We don't hear a lot about redwoods in Wisconsin as far as in our yards and forests too much. And I've seen these trees at a big box retailer last year, and I bought one, kind of studied up on the internet a little bit, and it sounds like it's very fast growing and loses its needles every year, kind of like a regular tree, but not sure if, you know, buying things from the big box means they're necessarily suitable for this area. So,
Larry, dawn redwoods are such beautiful trees, but they're not hardy up in Rice Lake. I can guarantee you that. They're a zone, they're a zone 5B plant. Even in Madison, if the winters are severe, we'll have the top part of the tree die back. It's one of my ultimate favorite plants. It's absolutely gorgeous, but it's definitely a Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, and Madison tree. It's not up where you are. You're near Spooner, and no, that's way too north for that. And that's a problem with some of these big box stores. They're ordering plants for a large part of the country, and you know, exactly. Some of the plants are just not hardy.
Well, thank you very much. I kind of suspected that, and then you confirmed my suspicion.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry.
No, they sound really nice, but not for here.
No.
All right. Thanks, Larry, for calling. That's too bad. Ashley in Green Bay. Let's see here. Let's go to Ashley. Hi, Ashley. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay. I bought a house like a year and a half ago. Yeah. And I have a tamarack tree in my backyard. And my 7-year-old calls it her truffle tree, like from the movie The Lorax, because it's that stringy and kind of nothing to it. Is that the way it's supposed to be? Is it healthy?
Well, I'd have to kind of see pictures, but a tamarack tree, it's also known as larch.
Or was it tamarisk? That was my
question. It's a tree, so it would be... Okay. It doesn't have pink flowers, correct?
Yeah, I don't know. It has a little like purplish bud type things. They don't flower. They don't do anything.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It's a tamarack tree. It's a larch. We have our Native American larch in the state, and there's also the Japanese larch and the European larch. All three species lose their leaves in fall. They have great fall color, nice bright yellow fall color, and lose their leaves, and then the needles come out in spring. Very beautiful trees. How long have you had this?
I just moved in, but I was told it's been there for a very long time.
Yeah, they look kind of homely at this time of year when they don't have any needles on it. They're kind of stringy looking, and they have lots of cones hanging on the branches, but that's normal.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for calling. And Rick and Holman, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding oak wilt. We have we're on a woody lot with probably about 10 acres of oak woods, and we've had about 3 large oaks die all in sequence up a hill. And wondering if there's a good, we've heard about trenching and not moving wood, but wondering if there's a good time of the year or a specific time of the year where that kind of control method would be applied.
Yeah, you could certainly do it. You know, I would tend to do it late in the fall, early in the spring. The question I have is whether it's really oak wilt or not. And the reason why I'm asking this, have you had the trees tested to verify?
No, we haven't had the trees tested. We have had some other oaks, like on the other end of that 10-acre property, mm-hmm. that have displayed some elements, and they were tested, and it was not oak wilt.
Okay.
They're coming back year after year. Hardy.
Yeah.
These woods, these would be probably 50-foot tall oaks with a trunk about, well, some of them are a foot, some of them are 3 feet in diameter, and the whole tree just dies.
Yeah. The reason why I'm asking this is because a lot of people attempt to diagnose oak wilt based on dieback symptoms, visual symptoms, and because one of the strategies for dealing with oak wilt is this root pruning, this trenching technique, I really want to know that it truly is oak wilt, because the other thing that can kind of mimic oak wilt is, I mentioned a disease earlier called armillaria root disease, and that particular fungus, the way it tends to get into trees, it mimics the symptoms of oak wilt, but the way it gets in is through wounds in the root system. So if you're dealing with armillaria and you think it's oak wilt and you do the trenching, you can potentially make the problem worse. So what I would suggest would be to watch those oak trees in the vicinity of the ones that have died back. If you start to see one of them start to wilt or have branches that die back, get a sample into my clinic so that we can verify that it's oak wilt before you do that trenching, because I would hate to have you trench and it be the wrong disease, and then all of a sudden you've made the problem worse.
Sure, good advice. What elements of the sample do you need?
What I would do is watch for branches that just start, the leaves start to brown up or the branches start to wilt back. I need branches that are roughly an inch in diameter. I like to have typically 3 branches of that size from the tree. I definitely, as you remove those, just in case, paint over the wounds. Just in case it is an oak wilt, so you don't open the tree up to infection by the oak wilt fungus as the insects are coming in. And then you mail that, keep that as cool as possible, And then I would overnight mail that if you can to me. If you can keep it on ice and mail it with some ice packs or something of that sort to my clinic in Madison. Again, if you go to my clinic website, you're hooked up to the internet, so you can find my website.
Yep.
Okay. PDDC.wisc.edu. And then there's information on where to ship it. There's a sample submission tab in the main page, and that has the information on the address and how to get it in. And we do charge for that. It's a $20 charge, but I really hate for you to have our malaria and think it's Oakwilt and then make things worse. That just, it really disturbs me that there's a lot of visual assessment for Oakwilt, and I'm never quite sure that it actually is.
And be sure to mail it early in the week?
Early in the week, definitely. The worst thing we can have happen is for the sample to arrive on a Saturday or Sunday and sit around someplace. We want to get to those samples as quickly as possible, and keeping them as cool as possible is very, very important. We learned that, especially in 2012, when it was so hot. We had a lot of people sending in Oakwilt samples, and we could not culture the fungus from those samples because it was just too hot and dry. The fungus apparently was dying off in the trees. Didn't cure the trees, unfortunately, but it just prevented us from confirming. But in a typical year, if you keep those samples cool, get them quickly to our office, we should be able to grow the fungus out quite readily.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Matthew in Dunn County. Hi, thanks for calling. Do you have a quick question?
Yeah, Larry. I don't know if it's a township or the county, but they come by to clean up the sides of the roads with a tractor, and attached to it is like a giant blade. Mm-hmm. And they just come by knocking down tree branches and brush. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a dog came through and chewed out everything.
Yeah.
And it's got to be promoting disease and what have you, is my guess, but what's my recourse? Can I talk to my extension? They don't clean anything up. They don't use chainsaws.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah, that's a great way, depending upon the particular species of plant, to move disease-causing organisms around. You're making really rough cuts, for one thing. You could be potentially picking up pathogens on those cutting blades and just transferring it as you cut down the road. The extension office probably is not going to be able to help you. This is more something I would discuss with the actual municipality. Yeah. And talk to them about the fact that this is probably not the best way to be doing this if they really want those trees to survive long term.
Yeah. You know, I see it all the time.
Yeah.
And just to prove the point that miracles can happen, James emailed us to say that he has a Dawn Redwood doing very well in northern Winnebago County.
Yeah, I'm not saying it can't. I've even seen one in Green Bay. It's a very protected location that they're in. But again, the previous caller was from Rice Lake, and that's way up in near Spooner, Wisconsin. And that is just, I wouldn't risk planting a Dawn Redwood up there.
Yeah, and it's far from a lake, any sort of body of water that's going to moderate climate. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the likelihood of that surviving is pretty
and,
poor.
And Winnebago is now considered Zone 5, whereas Rice Lake is right on the cusp of 4 and 3.
Yeah, so, okay.
Now, even I as a plant pathologist, I love to hear success stories because I usually am seeing doom and gloom.
And I'm the tree hugger, so I like seeing Dawn Redwoods in Winnebago County.
My favorite story is when Scott Craven was on, somebody said, I have a prairie dog in my pasture. And Scott said, that's impossible. There can be no, and here in Wisconsin, they're just not here. Then he went out and looked, and it was a prairie dog.
Oh, wow.
And it had come in on a baled, one of these big round bales from some hay from out west.
Oh, wow.
That poor prairie dog lived for a few years. All by itself, a very social animal. But. And we're social, and we're also thankful. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Laura, for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
It's been great being here. Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
we will have them back. Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Laura Jahl from UW-Madison, UW Extension. She is a woody ornamental specialist. And, hey, thank you for listening. We'll be talking with physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody on Monday talking about plantar fasciitis, among other things. Oh, stay with us on the Ideas Network.